We're back after a much-needed hiatus where I haven't heard from Michael what he did, went off to Yellowstone with three generations of Baker and shared trails with Bison, who it turns out luckily moved to the left when we meet oncoming traffic, which is what we did. Woke up to wolf howls in the morning and did some grandfather and grandson bonding over marshmallows and the first fish they'd ever caught. So it was very exciting. We're back. Michael, what did you do during the hiatus?
I slaved away in the office. You know, somebody had to man the place while everybody else was gallivanting around the world.
Well, we're gonna hear from you what's happening in the Microsoft overseas discovery warrant case, and I'm sure that was a big chunk of your August. My sense is the law business is finally starting to pick up. If this August, this has probably been the busiest August in 5 years at the firm. So maybe the long legal recession is finally at an end, and the people who graduated from law school in the last 5 years have some hope of finding jobs. I guess I should say, welcome to episode 32 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, who we've already heard from, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Guest commentator today, I'm really pleased to have with us in the conference room, is David Hoffman, Intel's Chief Privacy Officer and, in my view, one of the most thoughtful privacy observers, though I don't often agree with him, going. So welcome, David.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you for having me.
And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe to practice law the most number of times. So let's get started. We're going to have to do this month in NSA rather than this week, and a very brief touching on the highlights of August, which luckily turned out to be a typical August in that there was less happening generally, certainly in government. If I had to say what was the most important story that came out of NSA during August, interestingly, the Glenn Greenwald Snowdenista news machine is not really generating the big news anymore. There are a few stories, but I think probably the most interesting thing for people who follow NSA was the release by the DNI of the of another Judge Bates redacted opinion, which gives us a much better idea of the abandoned orphan program that has gotten less attention, but which certainly caused more trouble during its existence, which was the twin to the phone metadata program. There was, in essence, an internet metadata program in which looked a lot like the phone program. It was an effort to collect communications to and from the United States, just looking at metadata rather than content to spot connections between foreign terrorists and Americans. It ran from 2001 until 2011 and then was dropped by the administration. And this opinion gives you a good sense of why. It's pretty clear that there were far more problems actually trying to make that program work within the limits that had been promised to the FISA court than there had been with the 215 phone metadata program. And if you're interested, I think it's really the first, you only have to read the first 20 or 25 pages of that opinion to get a feel for that. The rest of it is actually, I don't know, Michael, you looked at it, but I thought the rest of it was pretty standard fare. But the sense of just how hard it was for NSA to satisfy Judge Bates, to make the promises that they made actually come true was pretty interesting.
Oh yeah, it's, you know, it was interesting from a couple of perspectives. One, Judge Bates, you know, assumed that the program, although poorly implemented, was consistent with the statute, which is odd because the Penn Trap statute doesn't really seem to envision bulk collection. It seems to envision collection targeted at a specific person.
Yeah, but it isn't the standard relevance there too. So once you've crossed the Rubicon and decided that it's that relevance can be decided by after the fact processing rather than prior determination, the same kind of process, collect it all and then restrict exactly how it's searched, seems to me to fall pretty neatly out of the relevance language.
Yeah, you know, I think that argument, which has been proffered to justify the 215 program, I think is on even weaker ground here, since the rest of the provision really does talk about an investigation into an individual. And so logically, you can say that all metadata involving every person, or at least here, every non-U.S. person abroad, is relevant to the investigation of a particular person, but I just think in common sense terms, that is a whole lot more tenuous, I think, the logic.
And
inconsistent with what Congress...
It does turn out, I suspect, that administration is lucky they didn't have to defend this one directly. It is not really part of the political firestorm, although almost all the fixes that are addressed to the 215 program are also going to make any future uses of the Penn Trap statute inconsistent of this sort, inconsistent with the new legislation.
Yeah, although you would think to the extent the 215 program goes forward, it would render much of this program redundant, I would think. If you can get everything under 215, then, you know, this is just a subset of that. But again, I think it depends on how 215 ends up being changed in the end.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the legislative language. I don't think that it broadens out 215 so that it can become a substitute for Penn Trap. I think you probably would still be stuck with the idea that Penn Trap is a more specific way of getting that information. But given that I think all of the, at least in the Senate bill, if I remember right, all of the special selection term restrictions and the prohibitions on bulk collection are in there for Penn Trap as well as for 215 subpoenas of business records.
Yeah, well, we have to look at that. That's interesting.
So the other NSA news is distinctly second tier. There's an effort to make an issue out of the fact that NSA developed a search engine for metadata, which I think the public response has been, well, what do you expect? They're an intelligence agency, and search engines are important ways of going through information. At least it hasn't developed any obvious political resonance. More egregiously, I thought Der Spiegel put out a piece that Laura Poitras, who's an echt Snowdenista journalist, contributed to, which was really, as far as I could see, almost purely an effort to sow discord between the United States and Turkey by revealing every possible targeting of Turkey by NSA in a lot of detail. There were no scandals about it. There are a lot of legitimate reasons why the U.S. government would want to gather intelligence on Turkey, but the Turks had been very sensitive about past disclosures, and Der Spiegel and Laura Poitras put out this story that just sort of taunted the Turks with the NSA collection. Maybe a subordinate motivation there, which shows up in the story, was to relieve the German government of embarrassment, because the German government had been disclosed by somebody other than the Snowdenistas as having spied on Turkey, and everyone in Germany said, yeah, well, sure, allies don't spy on allies, but Turkey, that's really important. We need to know a lot about Turkey. The irony of which argument they didn't quite recognize in a U.S.-Germany context. Speaking of U.S.-Germany, the Germans embarrassed themselves in another non-Snowdenista, I probably don't need to say, story that disclosed that the Germans had collected and recorded both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry's phone calls. With the argument that, well, they were on the same frequency, we were monitoring, it was just a mistake, we're really sorry. Oh yeah, we kept copies, but we've gotten rid of them now.
That to me is that defense is so laughable. It's just unbelievable that this was accidental. It was what, at least in the English translation, that the Germans refer to as bycatch, which I guess is their synonym for NSA's incidental collection, but. Here, they're not even arguing, well, you know, somehow the same search terms turn this up. They're arguing essentially what you just said, which makes no sense whatsoever. And then the other interesting thing I saw, at least in one article, I think from Der Spiegel, they said the data, once they realized it was collected, was supposed to be destroyed. And it wasn't immediately destroyed because the person responsible for the destruction was the guy who turned out to be an American spy in the German BND. Now, that's really funny. I mean, they're trying to pin the blame on the guy that they just caught spying for the U.S., which also just strikes me as incredibly unlikely.
Yeah, it is implausible, but I think it demonstrates that a lot of the remaining political juice in the Snowden leaks is draining away and turning into this sort of welter of, and your mom is another kind of accusations, with the German government luckily having more or less embarrassed itself pretty severely. So let's turn to stuff that is not directly NSA news, which is what you spent much of August on. And this is the Microsoft overseas warrant case, where the data is stored in Ireland. And the question is whether the U.S. government can issue a warrant in the U.S. to Microsoft saying, cough up that data. And there have been a couple of developments, and we may be on the cusp of another one. Michael, can you bring us up to date on where that case stands?
Yeah, as our readers may recall, Chief Judge Preska of the Southern District of New York upheld a magistrate's determination that Microsoft could be compelled with a search warrant under the Stored Communications Act to turn over to U.S. law enforcement emails that are stored in Ireland. She rejected Microsoft's argument, which we repeated in our amicus brief for Verizon, rejected the argument that search warrants don't have extraterritorial effect because she said essentially that a search warrant under the SCA is no different from a subpoena, and subpoenas can have extraterritorial effect, or at least can be used in the U.S. to force a company to bring back data stored abroad. But the judge the government consented to Microsoft's request for a stay pending appeal, and the judge granted the request for a stay, although she limited it just to give Microsoft enough time to seek a continuing stay in the Court of Appeals. But then the government changed its mind. And a couple of weeks ago, it filed a motion saying, you know, we've realized on further consideration that an order rejecting a motion to quash a search warrant is not a final appealable order. And so the judge should withdraw her stay, and she should direct Microsoft to comply. And if it doesn't comply, Microsoft should be held in contempt, and then it can appeal the contempt order, because a contempt order is a final appealable order. And it's weird because the government said in its motion that, well, we're not actually, you know, seeking to put anybody from Microsoft in jail for contempt, or we're not actually seeking to force them to comply, because they don't really have an urgent need for this information. But they just think they need to perfect the basis upon which to bring this up to the Second Circuit. So, you know, this was just last Friday. It was a nice parting gift for the long holiday weekend for Microsoft. So it remains to be seen what Microsoft's going to do, whether it's going to seek an emergency stay in the Second Circuit or go ahead and take a contempt order and wear it as a badge of honor to show how it defends privacy. I think we'll find out within the next couple of days. But it's, you know, it's not surprising Judge Preska denied the stay or vacated her stay motion, since she's really pro-government on this issue.
Yeah, but it does put Microsoft in an awkward spot. They have no idea what the penalty for contempt is going to be. They have to basically commit the crime before they can decide, you know, what kind of time they're going to do or what kind of penalty is going to be assessed. And notwithstanding the government's kind of hints that they don't really want anybody to go to jail, if I were Microsoft, I'm not sure I'd be completely comfortable relying on those hints.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because Judge Preska is a bit of a wild card on this, because she has gone, you know, a couple of times now she's gone farther than the government had asked her to. You know, like I mentioned, limiting the extent of the stay when she initially granted it. So even if they say, look, we don't want to put anybody in jail, she may say, hey, there's an outstanding order. That's about, you know, if they're flouting it, they're flouting my order, not yours, at this point. So, you know, like you say, you can't be sure what she's going to do.
So it will be interesting to see what Microsoft finally decides to do, and we'll find that out probably by the time we have our next podcast. We did see a little bit of development in a couple of other cases. LinkedIn continued a trend of settling data breach cases cheap, at least in my view. They had a breach for most of their paying customers. They ended up settling for $1.25 million. Michael, am I right to think that that is really quite inexpensive?
It's inexpensive, but you know, the thing that's a bit troublesome is up to $400,000 of that $1.25 million will go to the lawyers. Each person who was affected by the breach receives only up to $50, which is really not worth very much. And then whatever's left over, if you know, people who don't claim their $50, the rest of the money goes to I think CDT and a couple of other groups that are dedicated to privacy and cybersecurity. So it's not a lot of money, but it's mainly a windfall for the plaintiffs' lawyers and then you know, nonprofit groups. It doesn't benefit affected individuals at all, really.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you're a supporter of CDT.
Yeah, I think, but if plaintiff's lawyers can get past the motion to dismiss, which they're finding ways of doing at this point, then they're gonna. It doesn't require a lot of work to get a fairly decent payoff.
It's a payoff for sure to the plaintiff's lawyers, who are already pretty well incentivized to bring these cases, and we're gonna see plenty more of that. But the amount of money, even after a class certification, that is likely to be paid out strikes me as well within most companies' ability to handle. It'll become a tax on business rather than a true burden on companies' bottom line. It's my guess at any rate. NIST reached out during August and said we'd like comments from people on how the cybersecurity framework is working. And I think it's a little early to say myself, although my sense is it's getting lots of uptake, lots of mention. I've got a couple of cases already where the government has said we expect you to explain yourself in the terms that the cybersecurity framework lays out. What did you think of that that proposal?
Yeah, it did seem a little premature, and the specific questions they're interested in getting answers to are very general. including how did you find out about the cybersecurity framework? What do you think about it? They're not really asking for details about how has it helped, how has it helped you implement cybersecurity. It has the feeling of asking for a pat on the back, like, you know, former New York Mayor Ed Koch when he would go around saying, how am I doing?
How am I doing?
You didn't really want to hear criticism.
No, that's probably right. Let me ask David Hoffman to weigh in. You obviously see a lot of security issues inside companies. What's your sense of how well the cybersecurity framework is being treated and what changes, what new actions should NIST be taking to improve its value to the private sector?
Yeah, I guess the first thing I would say is I think it's appropriate for politicians to have that Ed Koch moment every once in a while. I think soliciting input to say, how am I doing, is generally a good thing, particularly in an structure that was intended as a public-private enterprise to develop voluntary guidelines that organizations would use.
It was so private sector focused that you really ought to be having a moment where you say, how are you doing? Because frankly, it was private sector that produced a large chunk of the work that went into the cybersecurity framework.
I think that it was fantastic that the government reached out to the private sector, since I think that's primarily where the expertise lies on how mm-hmm. you would implement something like this internally. We at Intel, we've been public on this. I've written blogs on this, as have other folks on our team, that we thought the administration's process was a good one, led to the right kinds of conversations. I think this is a good moment to take a step back and say, now that we have this document, what's it look like, and are people looking to implement it? And then particularly, what does this mean for using this document outside of the United States to point other governments to and say, this is the right way to look at cybersecurity regulation and to try to incentivize the private sector to take the steps that they should take? From Intel's perspective, this is a great thing for us to be able to go to other governments that hold out as a way to look at regulation.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Although I fear that just having the NIST label on it, sort of like having the European convention on cybersecurity, both of them will turn out to be as much a badge of dishonor and a reason not to adopt them until they've been renamed something, with the ITU's initials in it. But that said, I think it does make sense to start using these more aggressively internationally.
And I think it depends where you go. I think there are a lot of countries out there that look to the technical capability that NIST has and the consensus way that it builds these kinds of frameworks, and they do consider them. At least that's what we see.
Yeah. Well, and it would be silly, since the framework actually does try to incorporate ITU standards already, so that to say, well, we won't do that because it doesn't say ITU is a little misguided. Let me pick up on two other developments before we turn to David in more detail. I was struck by a recent Massachusetts decision with a weird interpretation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, essentially saying that you could wreck a computer, you could basically wipe out its hard drive, and there was no liability under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act if you had disconnected it from the internet first. Michael, is it really that dumb?
It could be. It depends on how it's interpreted. I think you can interpret it fairly narrowly, or you can interpret it broadly. The judge did indeed find let me describe the facts here. Basically, a person quit her company to go work for a competitor, but she didn't return her work-provided laptop for 2 months. And in those 2 months, she wiped the hard drive clean, so removed a bunch of customer-related files that were probably of use to the company she had just left. So they sued her under the CFAA. said that she had accessed the computer without authorization once she had left the company and damaged the information on the computer. And the court said, well, at the time she accessed the laptop, it was no longer being used in or affecting interstate commerce or communication, because that's the standard. The CFAA only applies to so-called protected computers, and to be a protected computer, it's got to be used in or affect interstate or foreign commerce or communication. And so if you interpret that broadly, it means that a hacker or a rogue employee can access a laptop or even potentially access stored data that's not presently being used at that moment in interstate commerce, and a court could find that it's at that point that the computer is not a protected computer. You could also interpret a little bit more narrowly, I guess, and in this case, the laptop hadn't been connected to the company's network for a while. It was just sitting there dormant for 2 months. And so I guess if you limit it to its facts, then the decision is not potentially damaging. So I think we'll just have to see. And this could be another instance of a poorly drafted complaint leading to potentially bad law. We see that a lot in the CFAA area.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, the civil litigation is exerting a weird and unfortunate hold on interpretation of the CFAA, and this is another example of a civil case arising in a slightly odd set of circumstances where the court has some incentive to get rid of the case if it can, doesn't feel like it's a federal case, which probably it isn't, and seizes on this as a basis to dismiss the suit.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So last case is something that I would have thought was completely white bread analysis of the Communications Decency Act, essentially creating an immunity for search engines from the content of the links that they turn up, or from their auto suggestions, which we've all experienced. We put our name in and then put the word is, and are frequently appalled by what follows. But the lack of liability for autocomplete is pretty standard CDA analysis. And the case is saying, once again, that there is an immunity for search engines is only striking because practically every other country seems to be going in the other direction. It's a real American exceptionalist moment. Michael, did you look at the case? Is it as plain vanilla as I thought of it from a U.S. legal point of view? And is there anybody else who's following us in this direction?
I think you're right in terms of the U.S. view on this. It is plain vanilla in the sense that there have been other courts that have decided the same way. I think there are at least some chocolate sprinkles on it, though, because I find the reasoning, I think the most charitable way to put it is that's a very broad interpretation of the CDA, because the logic is that the search engines are not creating the content which would deprive them of immunity. That you see in those auto suggest boxes or in the way they arrange the words, you know, on the Google or the Yahoo search page. Because the way they construct those things, the way they decide what to put in the search box when they auto complete it is based on an automatic algorithm. It's not made by a human person making a human decision. That seems like a strange logic to me to say that something's immune because it's done by a computer rather than a person. There's nothing in the statute itself to suggest that. But as you say, it is consistent with the general view of the courts in the U.S. that the statute should be interpreted broadly. But it is inconsistent with what courts are doing in Europe, where they are finding search engines liable for what they put on their results pages and in their auto in their search boxes when they do auto complete of search terms.
Sorry, David.
Yeah, I think Michael's analysis is spot on, and I think this is, we're going to get to this, I think, when we talk about the Google Spain case also. But this is a situation where different countries are coming to different conclusions, and the facts in the individual situation are incredibly important, particularly around the technology. So in Europe, the operate at the EU level, the operating legal instrument, I think, for most of this is Article 12 of the e-commerce directive, which tries to immunize from liability any technology or service that's acting as a mere conduit for of the information. But it goes beyond just saying mere conduit and actually gives criteria for how you would determine whether something is a mere conduit. And there's three main criteria. One is, does it initiate the transmission? Does it select the receiver of the transmission? And the third is, does it select or modify the information contained in the transmission? If you look at it technically and the role that a lot of these services provide, I think it's that third criteria that ends up being very difficult. And we're going to see a bunch of cases in Europe and potentially in other countries that are going to have to struggle with this. And I think we're probably going to have to struggle with this in the United States. What does it mean to select? What does it mean to modify? What is applying algorithms to this information and coming back with something that's different from what entered the pipe? What does that role mean? So I think we've got a lot of this to either look forward to or not look forward to, depending upon your perspective.
So I think you're right. I mean, I have some more sympathy for AutoSuggest, where as I think is the case, the auto suggestions are really simply the wisdom of crowds. It is the auto suggestions, you know, when you say David Hoffman is, the next word is the word most often entered by other people when they're doing searches. And if you look at it that way, it's not being supplied by Google or Bing. It's being supplied by all those other people who think that you're a hero. At another level, of course, it is selected by Google or Bing because they didn't have to put that up. They could have tinkered with it. And increasingly, as they have struggled with the question of what search results do people want, they no longer can say we are just producing the something completely mechanical. They can't explain their algorithm mechanically. They've had to say, you know, there are some people who have studied our search engine optimization, studied search engine optimization, and built a business around producing crappy stuff that nonetheless rises to the top of the search engine list. And we're going to go in and make adjustments to make that content drop in the rankings. And kind of most recently, Google announced that they were going to drop people in the ranking if they didn't use SSL TLS to connect to their customers, which has nothing to do or almost nothing to do with the quality of the content. And so increasingly, as Google, for good reasons and for ideological reasons, makes adjustments in how they choose that first page of links, that crucial first page, it's going to get harder for them to say, oh, we don't really select. That selection is done by some, you know, the great mass of people, and our algorithm simply assembles their votes and presents them to you, because that just isn't true anymore.
I agree with that, and maybe we can come back to this conversation. It really is that selection and the technologies that used to make that selection that's the competitive advantage. I love using search engines, and I find different search engines to be more useful than others, and right. For me, they get a competitive advantage for that.
The more curating they do, usually, the better. The more careful they are. Certainly, if they were mechanical and they could be gamed, we would not want them anymore. You're absolutely right, but that is driving them away from the CDA and into the arms of liability all across the world. Well, that's a brief tour of August, but I think a representative tour of the legal developments in the month. And let's just jump into Google in Europe and the right to be forgotten, which we've talked about a few times. You know, I think it's preposterous.
I think you used the term clinically insane.
I did. I know you are less harsh in your judgment on them, and in particular on the Court of Justice. So what's your overall take on this, and where do you see it going?
I think first what I would say is that, you know, on clinically insane, I would say I think it's fairly clinical. I'm not sure whether I would say it's insane. I know I wouldn't say it's insane. Actually, I think you have to separate this into three different categories. The first category is you have to just look at the interpretation of the law itself from the face of the opinion, mm-hmm. and say, do we think that this is a defensible interpretation of the law? Let me come back. You know, we can come back to that and we can talk about it. I think we then have to say, well, based on that interpretation of the law, can you implement it? You know, which
right.
the court was not charged with the responsibility of telling people how you would go implement that. And we should talk a little bit about the procedure of how this court was evaluating these questions. And then I think the third category is the policy implications. What does this mean for how we might want to change the law in the future, particularly as Europe is going through this process of thinking about whether they want to have this general data protection regulation go from draft to final form, and what would be in that? So,
I actually think we can move the discussion along pretty quickly. Because I think on the question of was this a plausible interpretation of what the directive says, my sense is yes, the directive is nuts too, and it has been. I mean, it was written essentially in the 70s, although updated in 95, on the notion that there's something spooky and weird and dangerous about having databases, which is another word for Excel spreadsheets in many respects. And this was, you know, from the days when you had to have an IBM computer and you had to be an enormous institution to assemble those kinds of databases on people. And the idea was, well, we'll treat them the way New York City or Chicago treats handguns. You come in and you register it and you're under suspicion and we're going to demand a justification for why you have this dangerous thing and you've got to show that you're using it responsibly. The idea that all of us would go around registering every spreadsheet we create that has any personal data is preposterous, but that's what the reg says. What the court did was, I think, at one level, you could say, is we refuse to accommodate this astonishing and outdated law to the realities that we live in. That's somebody else's job. I think they did it with more enthusiasm than that, and that it was a hostility to Google that motivated that, because they were given by the Advocate General a way out to say that this is not what the law requires. But they refused to accept any of those policy-based reasons for not reading the directive kind of literally.
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting. Once again, this gets to broader philosophical questions about how people feel about judicial activism. I mean, I think the European Court of Justice is charged with a specific responsibility, which is to provide interpretations of European law to the high courts in the EU member states. They were given some fairly specific questions. Now, there are some instances within this that you can say they didn't fully answer some of the questions. So, for instance, if you look at the actual rulings that they came up, they never used the language, the right to be forgotten. The rulings from the Court of Justice never say there is a right to be forgotten. Instead, they say that if you look at Article 12B of the directive and Article 6.1C of the directive, that you have a right as an individual to demand rectification or erasure of information that does not comply with the obligations of the directive as it's been implemented in member state law. So they're telling the Spanish, now you go interpret your law, but we're going to tell you the interpretation on the basis of the language of the directive is, yes, that right does exist. And it was more complicated. They're also getting into issues around jurisdiction and interpretations of whether you're a controller or a processor. But what I hear you saying, Stuart, is the court was not clinically insane. They may be interpreting a clinically insane law that they themselves did not at least say in the opinion, this is a clinically insane law and needs to be modernized. And that brings up the bigger question then is, we have a process right now going on in Europe to potentially modernize this law. I've heard a lot of people say, let's leave the law the way it is. We're fine. I'm actually surprised. That hasn't been Intel's opinion. It's not my opinion. I think we do need to modernize the directive. To some extent, we here in the U.S. have to be careful about what we criticize because we gave most of these principles to them. You talk about how they demonize, you know, databases, but it was the activities that led up to the creation of the 1974 Privacy Act that created these fair information practice principles that they then took on over in Europe, also with some pre-existing privacy laws in individual European countries. So, I think we can say we don't like the way this law functions now, but I think if we're going to say that, what's really helpful for us to do is then come and say, well, what should we do in place of this? And so that gets more to the policy question, although I do think there are some really interesting issues in this case around the law itself, particularly when you get into the situation of having to balance issues around privacy also with issues of free expression. This case is, I think, much more complicated than even the opinion notes, and it's a fairly complicated opinion. You've got an opinion that was written in French that we're all reading in English when it's been translated, and we're trying to hinge importance on the opinion on a couple of words in different places, which is always fraught with difficulty and error. What I keep coming back is saying, at least on the law portion, we need to wait for the Spanish High Court now. We've had an opinion written by the European Court of Justice, which is really an advisory opinion to the Spanish, saying, you have our opinion of European law. Now you create an opinion on a final ruling based on your Spanish implementing law. And, of course, the law in Spain, since the directive is a floor and not a ceiling, could be even more stringent when the interpretation comes from Spain. The thing that I think is really difficult is, especially on the law, the way the directive works, we could have 28 different interpretations by different member states. This is the thing I'm most concerned about, is it's already completely unfair to make the search engines now make all of these distinctions about when information is adequate, relevant, and not excessive. Imagine now that they've got to try to interpret how 28 different regulators are going to answer that question.
Yeah, that's crazy. They really should just say, not our job. We're going to, you know, you send us the complaints and we'll package them up and send them to your local DPA, and your local DPA will rule on this and tell us what the answer is. Of course, there have been 250,000, if I understand it right, such requests filed, which would certainly give a workout to most of these DPAs, whose staffs are probably numbered in dozens at best.
And I'm not sure we really want that, although I think that would have been a defensible position for the search engines to take. I wrote a different idea that I posted at our Intel policy blog, which I said, how about what's also not... I think fair is to expect multiple search engines to be making determinations on the same facts and potentially coming up with different conclusions. That's not fair to the individual who's asking for rectification. It's not an efficient use of resources, and it's not fair to the authorities that have to supervise them that may have jurisdiction over some and may not have jurisdiction over others. I've said, where's a proposal where we would say, let's set up some sort of entity that would actually make these kinds of determinations, have the right level of oversight for it, and immunize private entities like search engines or data brokers from liability from complying with the determinations that are made. But I called it an obscurity center because I actually don't think I don't think this is about forgetting in any way. The original newspaper story is allowed to be there. And the Advocate General, I know a lot of people like the Advocate General's opinion. I think there's many strange parts of that Advocate General opinion, one of them being where the Advocate General said, oh, once you can't search for something using the search engine, there's no way you can find that information. It's basically what he said. I think it's in paragraph either 42 or 45 of the opinion. Well, I talked to librarians. That's not necessarily their opinion, right?
That's true, although that many of the skills that they use to find those things are atrophying because who needs them anymore?
Right? But let's take this case as a great example. Okay, I know I want to find some information about debts owed and real estate auctions in Spain. How hard is it to then find out what Spanish newspapers those would be published in and go take a look at the archives, which, by the way, are all online, which is the whole point, that they were online and being pointed to, and you could go search those individual. That would probably, I think, take me about 5 minutes online to do.
But so, wouldn't you then become yourself a data processor who has an obligation to suppress this information if it's no longer relevant? And don't you have warning by virtue of its being missing from Google and Bing that it is something that is at least arguably no longer relevant?
I don't think so. I've heard that argument made. I've tried to think about it, and maybe you can help me here. I don't see how you would get around the jurisdiction argument to how that would apply to me. How could the regulator try to apply that to me? The only way they could apply the law to Google.
If you make any money out of Spain, you have any way of making money that is tied in any way to your processing, which is really the standard that I think the European Court of Justice was applying. And why are you doing it if you aren't making money, unless it's a purely personal expedition? It's most likely that you're looking at it to decide whether this guy ought to get credit or whether you want your daughter to date him.
I think it's a good point, but I'm not sure that that's actually what the language of the opinion I think the language was much more constrained about the connection, and it was actually using an earlier Article 29 Working Party opinion about search engines that said when it's actually you set up a branch or a subsidiary in that jurisdiction, and their activities are inextricably linked, not connected in any way, but inextricably linked to the actual data processing that's going on, then they were going to apply jurisdiction. Now, one thing that I thought was interesting is that's a bit different from a question of applicable law, and I think several European lawyers have been saying, could there have been an argument that Google could have made here that Spain would have jurisdiction, but the applicable law should have been the UK? Mm-hmm. Maybe. I think it would have been a hard case to make that, but possibly. I think the jurisdiction issue is more difficult than what you were calling it out to be.
Okay. But the fact is they were collecting ads. The ads might or might not show up against any ads purchased by Spanish entities might or might not show up against this search of this guy. It's quite possible that instead that you'd get Akaiberry ads posted by somebody in the United States if you searched for this particular guy's name, right?
Potentially, although I think the entire business model of search engines is to get that as close as it can be. That's not the case, right? So I think the court was saying, look, the entire purpose here is to have ads that are as linked as closely as it can to the subject matter that's being searched for.
So what do you think then on the well, we've seen Google implement this. They either volunteered or were stuck with implementation. I posted something this weekend on their implementation, but I wondered what you thought of their implementation overall.
I think once again we had an advisory opinion from the European Court of Justice that, at least on its face, is limited to a very narrow set of facts. So you had a situation where you had 16-year-old financial data that resulted from the search of someone's name. It's not clear to me that based on that advisory opinion, anyone was forced to a much broader implementation of that. So that's a difficult decision between lawyers and clients about how much risk is there from doing anything short of that.
But given if you knew how much the European elite hates Google, and you were Google, you wouldn't want to assume that you were going to get any breaks in the later enforcement process, and you'd be running the risk that every single refusal produced very substantial liability in Europe.
Yeah, I think the conversations with information commissioners, potentially, I wasn't party to them, but I think what has been written about this so far points to the conclusion that the individual information commissioners were not necessarily looking for this level of implementation, and that there's a process going on at the Article 29 Working Party to try to figure out some criteria of how you would implement. I think at least Intel's experience with the information commissioners is that while they're going through a process to develop criteria, they are somewhat reticent to enforce against entities that are waiting for those criteria. So I can understand why it would happen. It's not clear to me it was the only option.
So the implementation that I was struck by, and you're part of this story now, Google started out saying, well, in China, when we censor our ordinary results, we tell people, by the way, you know, this search for Tiananmen Square doesn't include some relevant data because we've been told we can't include it. And so we'll do the same thing in Europe. It's European censorship. We're not allowed to talk about something that we think is relevant. So we'll just tell people, by the way, your search results have been censored. Not surprisingly, the European data protection authorities didn't see themselves in the same light as China's censors, even though I do. They reacted badly to that idea and leaned on Google not to include that on individualized searches where data had been suppressed. And their argument was in part that this will expose the fact that a particular name is being that a particular person has asked for the withdrawal of certain information, and that's basically a hunting license for the librarians of Europe to try to figure out what was left out. So Google said, okay, so we'll just do that anytime anybody searches for any name. And then they realized that was a little silly because famous people rarely asked for, successfully at least, the non-disclosure of information. So they said, but if you're famous enough, we won't run that that language because we don't take down, in the absence of compelling reasons, we don't take down information about Rihanna because she's a public figure and so famous. So they now have come up with a test that says every name that's searched for has a disclosure under google.co.uk that says, by the way, we sometimes don't disclose information because of European data protection law, unless you're really famous, in which case we don't run that tag, which led me to the conclusion that you could determine whether Google thought you were famous just by running your name through the google.co.uk. And so I did it naturally for myself first and then for you. And it turns out that Google omits that tag for both of us, which means that we are Google famous, whatever that means. Very weird. Other people that you would think of, surely more famous than we, Nuala O'Connor is not Google famous. David Medin is not Google famous. He's the head of the P Club. But Jim Dempsey, who's a member of the P Club, is Google famous. It's a very strange set of results that I just posted.
Well, if I wasn't famous before, now that I've been on your podcast, I'm sure I clearly will qualify now.
Clearly do it. Anyway, I feel sorry for Google that they're stuck with all of these peculiar results, although...
And it can't be the solution in the end, no. Right? To ask each individual company to make determinations, not just under 6.1c of the directive of what's adequate, relevant, not excessive, but also to have to make a decision about who is enough of a public figure to not be have the free expression interests counteract that. What I find interesting about this, once again, getting... back, you know, into the law again, is that there's actually a great history of case law in Europe on those particular issues, but they tend to be from the European Court of Human Rights, which is a different court from the European Court of Justice. Now, the European Court of Justice is supposed to give value to the opinions of the European Court of Human Rights, which has this history of balancing, I think it's the rights from Article A and or 8 and Article 10, which is the right to privacy and the right to free expression. There's some really interesting case law that actually creates criteria for what a public figure would be. I think I'm not a fan completely of the opinion, because I actually think the European Court of Justice should have built that into their opinion. You know, there's this a very famous case, Axel Springer v. Germany, that had, I think it's six different criteria for what is a public figure, and it's about related to the individual context of the issue. So just real quickly, it's whether it contributes to a debate of general interest, how well known is the person concerned, what is the subject of the report, prior conduct of the person concerned, method of obtaining the information and its veracity, content, form, and consequences of the publication, and severity of the action sanction imposed. I think that could be something really interesting to start working with from a European perspective.
I think the problem with that test is it's a legacy mainstream media analysis when, you know, yeah, if you were in the New York Times a lot, you were probably a public figure. But now, as they say, on the internet, everybody's famous for 15 people. You can be very famous in a small circle that follows you very closely and of no interest. This is how you and I got on the list. And of no interest to the rest of the world. How do you handle that?
Well, this might be where the problem actually provides you with a solution. And once again, that it's context specific. Come back to the court case that we're talking about. It was a search of the name, not a search of that individual context where you might be famous. So mm-hmm. If you do a search of David A. Hoffman, A being my middle initial, which I don't mind disclosing, because you will actually find that there are three different lawyers that practice something related to privacy law that are all named David A. Hoffman.
Difficult to distinguish. I recommend that our listeners do an image search of David Hoffman, because I have never seen somebody so buff as the David Hoffman who shows up in that search. It was apparently a weightlifter.
There is a bodybuilder, there's a documentary director, and a famous jazz musician, all with the same name. But if you search within a context, all you have to do is put Intel. Or right. I teach an information privacy law class at Duke Law School, and all you have to put is Duke in there next to it, and all of a sudden you get the hits coming back. And I think that's an interesting question. If you look at this opinion, if you added those elements to the search, would it be the linking to that data then? Would it be relevant, excessive, or not relevant, or adequate? And I think likely not would be my interpretation. So to me, and I raised this with the students in my class last night, I think it brings up a really important issue, which is not just a European issue, but if you read the FTC's data broker report, they're struggling with this also, of the impact of things that they're calling people search services. What does this mean? And we have once again a 30-year history in the United States of being concerned about people search services. And should there be specific requirements for and controls around information that's true but is being used in these people search services?
I would argue that we had that because there was a business and you could point to four companies and say they do this kind of credit report searches and that that sort of data gathering is totally democratized by the internet and search engines.
I'm not sure how democratized it is. How many big search engines are there that people use? It may be that it's changed and they now use the search engines for that service, or commercially there might be a certain number of data brokers that are used for that same service. It's not clear to me how democratized that is, though.
Well, in the sense that it's not that Google goes out to develop credit reports on people. It's just that you can tell what somebody's credit is like using Google if you run searches on their name and certain other characteristics. And you'd have to regulate the people who are doing the searches, not not Google, it seems to me. Although I suppose you could make the argument the other way. But you're working against the technology when you try to say, there are some searches I don't want people to be able to do. In the old days when you could say there are some companies who are gathering this information and it was a big effort on their part to do it, and you could measure their effort, you could look at their revenues, you could regulate them as a kind of utility. Now you really would, it's sort of like preventing copyright violations, which used to be you could find a few people who were engaged in that, who were selling the CDs at swap meets and the like, and you could punish them. Now it's everybody. Every 13-year-old kid can do it. And that changes both the enforcement climate and, as a practical matter, your policy choices.
And it feels to me like this is coming back to the conversation we had earlier about the CDA and the e-commerce directive and the changes of technology and the degree to which it may be more difficult to be an intermediary that's more than a mere conduit, and what's going to be expected. I think potentially you and I are coming together on this to say, this is a challenging issue, but with real consequences both ways, for individuals and for the companies that need to comply with it. And I think actually the Europeans knew that. One thing that I haven't heard on your podcast before and haven't seen a lot in the media about the opinion is a recognition that very few of the cases that go to the European Court of Justice are done in what they call the Grand Chamber. So there are 28 justices, one from each member state, that sit on the European Court of Justice. Usually they hear cases in 3 to 5 judge panels. They decided to hear this one in what they call plenary, and which is not 28 judges, interestingly. It's 15 judges, but it includes the head judge and president and vice president of the court, and then the head of each individual panel that sit on this. And I think they did that to recognizing this is a really important issue, one that has real consequences. I asked my students, I asked them last night and used the hypothetical, what do you do if someone breaks into your house, puts a wireless camera in your house that records a bunch of video from in your house, and then posts that to the internet? Should you not have any legal ability to obscure that so that people couldn't find it? This is true information about you, but it was illegally obtained. You could potentially go prosecute the person who broke into your house and put it there, but how do you get the content so that it's not out there forever and be obscured? Yet, how do we do that in a way that entities really could implement? This is going to be a complicated conversation.
Yeah, although I don't think anybody would argue that a legally mandated notice in the newspaper is equivalent to a crime. There are a few laws in the U.S., and they're actually controversial and have been limited by the courts, that say, if you'd wiretap somebody and then release the contents, the people who release it also have liability. That's not true. Just the people who carried out the wiretap. And when confronted with that possibility, with the possibility of imposing liability on people who released it, the court said, well, not if it's political speech and of a matter of public interest. We're just not going to read the law to do that. Well, let me bring this back to the U.S. because I know we're running low on time. and ask this. I mean, my nightmare is that this prevents me from finding out stuff, because I believe that this will 90% of the time be used to withhold information that is directly relevant on behalf of people who have some kind of power, money, political power, and the like, and that the number of innocent individuals who are going to be benefited by this is going to be dwarfed by the number of bad actors and wealthy individuals who manage to invoke the process. And so my nightmare is that it will start applying to the information that I can get, which is to say to Google.com, not just to Google.co.uk. What's your sense about where that stands? My impression is that the data protection authorities are grumbling pretty heavily about the idea that you could just have to flip over to Google.com to do a search that is unrestricted by European law, and they would love to be censoring the results that Americans can read as well. Google's resisted that so far, but you know, if there's liability for not censoring Google.com, it's kind of hard to see how they will continue to fight that for very long. What's your sense about where the DPAs are going to come out on that?
Not sure I have a sense on that. You know, I think there is going to be a complicated discussion on jurisdiction, and that will potentially be changed on by how some of these entities may even change some of their internal structures, where they sell advertising, how they sell advertising, where they have equipment, where they don't have equipment. What I would say is that I think based on what we've seen so far, I think it's reasonable to be concerned about that. I think everyone should be a bit worried and be following this and saying, how much free expression is this going to curtail? How much more difficult is this going to be to get information? If it means, though, that it's similar to what happened in this case, that it takes 5 minutes more to find 16-year-old financial data that here in the United States we would even say shouldn't be used to be making most decisions based on it, which is what the FCRA would be, I mean, I would say you could probably delegate that to an associate or paralegal and not be impacted that much. So, I you know, once again, I think we've got to play an active role in the conversation of what this narrow and limited opinion is going to mean from a policy perspective. I think we should be concerned about a data protection directive that applies to 28 different member states and can be implemented and interpreted in different ways. And we've got to figure out how to have some sort of a harmonized interpretation that works for individuals and still allows for the powerful use of data.
So the policy idea that I've been playing with over the weekend is this. In 1938, when Germans were trying to influence American policy through the German-American Bund and America First and a few other places in favor of Nazi Germany, Congress passed a law saying that all foreign agents of foreign governments, other than the people who actually, you know, were ambassadors of the countries, had to register and had to label the propaganda that they were putting out, any political statements they were putting out, as sourced by at the direction of a foreign government. That law is still on the books, and it seems to me there's at least a plausible argument here that if information is being provided to Americans, in many cases primarily to Americans, say on Google.com, and it is being influenced and directed by a foreign government, it should bear exactly the same warning label that the pamphlets that were being published by the German-American Bund had, which is to say this information has been tailored by a foreign government, and you should read it with that in mind. And maybe that means that anything that happens on Google.com does have to bear the disclosure that a particular search has been changed at the instance of some other government's law. There's a lot of work that you'd have to pursue to actually make that that policy a legal requirement. But it's not inconsistent with the statute as written, and the government, the U.S. government, probably has the authority to say, yeah, that's our solution to this problem.
But what
I like about that is now it gives the U.S. government something other than, you know, pretty please, hat in hand, requests to make of the Europeans. They can say, well, you know, you can regulate this stuff if you want, but we are going to regulate anything that you regulate. And we are going to require disclosure of every search that you tell Google and Bing to take down, because we are going to publish it. Because we want the Americans to see what foreign governments' censorship activities look like inside the United States. They could do that with Baidu, search engine out of China that still returns inside the U.S., very bowdlerized returns for Tiananmen Square, and they could do it for the European governments as well. So my hope is that maybe we can find a way to give them a little leverage to fight back on this, because otherwise, from Google's point of view, there's liability if they don't do exactly what the DPA, or at least potential liability, if they don't do what the most extreme DPAs want them to do. And there is no liability, indeed there's First Amendment protection, if they do exactly what the DPAs are asking for. So from their point of view, it would be crazy not to do pretty much what the DPAs tell them to do.
I think, as I said before, I think there are less restrictive means that could be used to implement this. You know, I held out one, which was the idea of creating some sort of an obscurity center. I would also say,
but no one would be able to find it.
But I would also say, I think if anybody has not heard that some of these search results might be getting modified as the basis of this ruling, they've been, you know, living under a rock. You know, there's been enough disclosure about this opinion that it's almost shocking how much this has made it into the popular press. So I expect, from what I hear, people say, well, you know, I know with almost any search that I do, you know, I might not be getting everything back, and I may need to dig into source documents a bit. So, you know, I want our online tools to be as effective as they possibly can. And, you know, Intel's business and most of my career has been about trying to design privacy in while still allowing for the innovative use of technology and data, and trying to say, I think that we can find solutions to do both. I think the Obscurity Center would be one way to potentially do that. There's probably others. I think it would be great if we could get together in a public conversation between companies and the regulators and folks who are concerned about this, particularly in civil society, and start coming up with some solutions.
Well, it would be interesting, and I you know, you'd have to include all of the content generators who are almost exclusively opposed to this whole idea, right? The people who generate most of the content tend to take it badly when they have their links, when they discover their links are no longer delivering any readers, are no longer getting any readers.
I will say, Mark Rotenberg at Epic gave me, which I want to give him full credit for this argument. He said, this is the best ruling ever for free expression. It's going to point everybody to the source newspapers, and they're going to have a lot more traffic coming to their sites. This is great for their business model, which I found just kind of interesting.
Could you have could it really be the case that, I guess it's probably true, if the Spanish newspaper allowed searches of their website, it would still turn up, right?
That's the whole point of the opinion, I think, actually.
So I could write a kind of, remember Dogpile?
Yeah.
Okay, so you create a search engine that just goes around dropping your search into the search engines of 50 major newspapers, just to see if they're different from the results you're getting on Google. As long as you know, potentially you'd be subject to the same restrictions. but surely why wouldn't the newspaper be subject to this? They can leave it in the printed press, but to make it available today as a link is a new form of processing. So they could be sued too for this.
They could. I think the court really signaled, though, when it was doing its balancing, was saying, look, we're taking a look at how much we're restricting free expression, and the fact that we're leaving it in the newspaper and in the online version of the newspaper, and that it just wouldn't come up on a search of the name and the name alone, this doesn't restrict free expression all of that much. I'm not saying necessarily whether I agree with that. I think it's a complicated analysis that's got to be part of the conversation. But it's tricky. I think, once again, when we get into the trying to optimize for both privacy and free expression, this is not just one side against another. I think Mark's argument was an innovative and counterintuitive one I thought was interesting. Another, though, I think also is having a system where you can search for anything ever said by anyone. What's the potential chilling effect from that on free expression? Do you have... constraints on free expression on both sides? Once again, I think I don't have the answers here, but I think we have not been having a nuanced conversation enough about it.
Interesting. Well, we certainly will, especially if you have anything to say about it, because it was a challenging and entertaining and very plausible defense of the decision, which I continue to believe is nuts, at least from a policy point of view. When we're going to close up, but when we stop, we usually give people an opportunity, starting with our guests, to talk about anything they're going to be doing or saying or releasing in the near future that our listeners ought to be watching for. So is there any speeches you have upcoming or documents you'll be releasing on this topic or others that we should be aware of?
I am going to be giving some remarks out at the International Association of Privacy Professionals Academy out in San Jose in a couple of weeks. We just published a blog about education privacy and the Hatch Bill and we're what modernization to FERPA should look like. We're looking to do a follow-up of that, and I am looking to do a more detailed follow-up of this Google Spain case document that we posted a blog on that would actually take the Advocate General's opinion and some of these European Convention of Human Rights cases and bring those in a little bit more.
Well, I think that'd be very interesting because you bring a certain American sensibility to the defense of what the European Court did that I think is a valuable contribution to the discussion. So I'm looking forward to that. Michael, anything that you want to tell the world about that you're going to be talking about or doing soon?
No, I'm going to try to really limit my public appearances so that I remain non-famous in Google's eyes and can, get disparaging remarks about me removed and hopefully have a better chance of not being regarded as a public figure if I want to sue someone for defamation.
You are on track, it looks like, although Lord only knows if there are enough hits on this podcast, you may be tipped over into Google fame. So this has been episode 32 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas and David Hoffman for a really vigorous discussion. We hope you'll join us next week when we will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy and government.